This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the MLB Pipeline Podcast. I'm Jason Ratliff with Jim Callis and Jonathan Mayo. We're going to talk Arizona Fall League, which is getting underway about a week from now, less than a week from now by the time you're listening to this. Last week we talked about some of the top players headed there. This week we're going to look at some of the sleepers, some sleeper prospects that'll be out in the desert for the next 6 weeks. We're also going to look ahead, preview some of our end of year awards. We have the prospect team of the year coming up. We have the overall hitting and pitching prospects of the year. We have each team's hitting and pitching prospect of the year, a bunch of those things coming your way soon. So we're going to preview that a little bit. And we are going to look at some of the 2022 draftees who had the best pro debuts this year. And then we'll wrap up by answering a question from, anybody know?
The post office.
Incorrect. Jim?
Are you talking about the person or the source?
Yeah, the source.
Well, I know because I pasted the question. I selected the question.
So oh, yeah. But, oh, that's
I'll,
right.
I'll keep it a secret.
Oh, we're not. Okay. Yeah. This week's mailbag question is slightly different than usual. You're right. Well, you got to stay tuned to find out. All right. Arizona Fall League. Jim, you are headed out there in a matter of days. The season
as
gets underway. Yeah, as am I. Season gets underway on the third Monday of October. We'll run 6 weeks, concluding with the championship game on, what, November 12th, I believe?
Sure.
The week before that, the Fall Stars game, one of the best events of the year in prospectum. Both of those games, the Arizona Fall Stars game and the championship game, will be on MLB Network. So we know there are 16 top 100 prospects headed to the Arizona Fall League. I don't know how many of the top 20 and 25, four or five. But we talked a lot about those guys. Last week, we had Jordan Walker on the show, who is the top ranked prospect headed to the Fall League. But we want to focus on some guys who are a little more under the radar. And as we were preparing for this, Jim was tooting his own horn.
He was
tooting everyone's horn.
The pipeline horn.
Last year we did this story, and Jim, Jonathan, and Sam, Sam Dykstra, nailed a lot of these sleeper prospects. As Jim has kindly provided a little intro for me here to this section, last year was the year of the sleeper, Jim says. Nelson Velasquez, Owen White, Juan Yepes, Elijah Donan, Logan Ohapi, all won major awards. Jose Tenya won the batting title. Curtis Meade, Caleb Killian also stood out, and Ezekiel Tovar, flash potential. All of those guys, Jim, were in our story last year where we highlighted and predicted guys who were sleeper prospects?
They weren't all in the story because Caleb Killian and Nelson Velasquez were both in the Cubs. And I think we didn't have Juan Yepes. Sam Dykstra and I were talking about this yesterday. Yepes was not our Cardinals sleeper, but Brendan Donovan was. He's had an excellent rookie season for the Cardinals. But yeah, most of these guys were. It was crazy. I mean, I didn't go back and do research on this, but I can't remember too many years in the Fall League where you've had that many guys who weren't big name. It seemed like most of the dominant prospects were not necessarily big name guys coming in. And it's been interesting that we've seen guys like Ohapi and Tovar and Owen White have all joined the top 100 this year after being, you know, relatively anonymous, at least in terms of top 100 acclaim going into the Fall League last year.
You know, that Cardinals contingent, Jim, Brendan Donovan was, as you mentioned, the sleeper prospect identified last year. And it said, you know, Nolan Gorman and Juan Yepes are two prominent infielders that the Cardinals sent to Arizona. And then out of all those guys, Lars Nootbaar might have had the best Fall League of any of them, was certainly got a lot of playing time out there and kind of made a, he seemed to pop onto the radar out there as well. So, all right. So this year's group, let's go team by team, Arizona Fall League team by team, and have you guys identify a couple guys each here. We will start in Glendale. Jonathan, who is someone on the Glendale roster that we should keep an eye out for, somebody who is maybe not a well-known name at this point?
Yeah, I went with Edouard Julien from the Twins organization. He's number 14 on the Twins top 30. So he's not completely off the radar, but this guy, kind of offensive-minded second baseman, not a great defender, but you know, always could hit. And he made the move up to Double A this year and hit very well, 931 OPS. He hit 300, had 17 homers, drew a ton of walks, 98 walks on the year, stole 19 bases. It was just a very, very solid offensive year. The questions about his defensive home kind of still remain, but just in terms of the left-handed bat, for a guy who was an 18th round pick out of Quebec. He went to Auburn, sorry, first, but you know, was a Canadian high schooler from Quebec, went to Auburn, hit there, and then was able to be eligible for the draft in 2019, went super late, and has already outperformed where he was drafted and will be knocking on the big league door next year.
He's got the Canadian spelling of, I don't know, is this Canadian, French?
Yeah, Edouard.
E-D-O-U-A-R-D. How was that pronunciation, Jim? I know you...
Yeah, he was one of my draft guys. Edouard, you got it correct. And Julien, Edouard Julien.
French flair on there.
Very nice.
Yeah, there was no flair from Jim. Edouard Julien. There you go.
Yeah, you couldn't tell my 5 years of high school French. They weren't evident there.
Jim Callis admitting he went to high school for 5 years. Interesting.
No, I took French one as an eighth grader.
Yeah, I started taking French.
I was like the Delmon Young. I was like the Delmon Young of the French scene at Oakton High School, probably performing at a high school level in eighth grade. So, or Dimitri Young. I think it was Dimitri Young. But anyway,
the meat hook.
Oh, sorry, I got carried away with the French thing.
I want you to do the rest of the podcast with your bad French accent.
I will not.
I thought you were going to take him up on that for sure.
I might. We'll see how it goes.
All right, Jim, give us a Glendale desert dog.
I'm fascinated by Logan Henderson, and I'm also fascinated by the Brewers seem to get the best junior college pitcher in almost every draft. They got Aaron Ashby, who's been, you know, a factor at the big league level. They got Antoine Kelly, who they traded for Matt Bush to the Rangers this year. They got my guy Jacob Mizorowski from last year's draft. You guys may have heard me talk about him about 1,000 times on the podcast. And in 2021, they got Logan Henderson from McLennan Community College in Texas. He led national JUCO pitchers in strikeouts with 169 in 97 and two-thirds innings. He struck out 17 in the championship game of the JUCO World Series as McLennan won the national title. He was a fourth-round pick, and he did not pitch a whole lot this year because he had elbow surgery. It was non-Tommy John surgery, but he came back and pitched 14 innings at the end of the year. And he's got, you know, it's funny. I remember talking to Todd Johnson, the Brewer scouting director, about how Logan Henderson kind of fascinated me. Because you kind of wondered, you know, how he dominated as much as he did without huge, huge stuff. I mean, he was 88, 92 most of last spring, topped out at 95 at the JUCO World Series, but it's one of those fastballs with high spin rates and it has great carry. His best pure pitch is probably a changeup that has a ton of tumble and fade in the low 80s. He can spin a mid-70s curveball that doesn't have a ton of power, but it's got nice shape. And the Brewers just seem to work magic with these JUCO pitchers. So I'm curious to see how Henderson did. You know, even though he only pitched 13 and two-thirds innings in pro ball, he struck out 23 guys. And I'm really curious to see exactly how his stuff works and if he could continue to miss bats, because he could be another one of these JUCO finds for the Brewers.
All right. So that's a couple of players from the Glendale Desert Dogs team to keep an eye on. That team, by the way, consistent of players from the following organizations: the White Sox, Reds, Dodgers, Brewers, and Twins. Let's move on to The Mesa Solar Sox, comprised of Cubs, Marlins, A's, Yankees, and Rays. Jonathan, in the words of a very wise man, who you got?
One thing I think we haven't really pointed out, I don't think, as we've been talking about the Fall League, is that, you know, the teams whose home is being used, and if that's our spring training home, they automatically play there. So Mesa, for instance, the Cubs are there, and the A's, even though they don't play in the same stadium. Anyway, I realized, I think last week when we kind of were breaking that down, we didn't point that out. So like Peoria, when we get to it, the Mariners and Padres play there because that's their spring training home. So I'm going with Ryan Cusick, and, you know, I don't know if a guy who was a first round pick just a year ago is a total sleeper, but he and JT Ginn are two pitchers that the A's got in trades that they made post lockout and who haven't really been able to show who they are because of injury. So I kind of lumped them together, but Cusick, I'll focus on, he's at 14 on the A's top 30. He missed a huge chunk of this season with an oblique strain. So he only threw like 40-some-odd innings, I think, 43 innings total, most of them in double A, got knocked around. He had struggled with command, but the stuff is really, really big. They got him from the Braves in the Matt Olson trade. And, you know, I think the A's are looking forward to seeing who he really is, just because he never really got on track, but the stuff still is unbelievable. He can be touch triple digits with a fastball with high spin rates. So he gets swings and misses up in the zone. He's focused more on a slider. Last summer during his pro debut, you know, it was brief, but it was a really good slider. It's mostly those two pitches. There is a pretty decent changeup. That's something maybe we'll see him working on in the fall league. So I think that his time this fall could help kind of let him right the ship and kind of let him float back up towards a more, I don't say elite level, but a higher level of pitching prospect than where he currently is.
I like that pick. Jim, I like your pick here too. And I think a lot of people are going to be interested to see this guy.
Yeah, he's my pick to win the AFL home run title, which I believe organization mate Nelson Velasquez did last year, if I remember correctly. But I went with Matt Mervis, and I think Cubs fans would be like, oh, he's not a sleeper, because he's like, as you guys may have heard, it's not been the greatest season for the Cubs. So I think most of the baseball excitement in Chicago right now is for Matt Mervis, as he's probably not going to get there, but he chases the minor league home run lead. He's got 36 right now. I think as we record this, there are 2 days remaining in the AAA season. He's got 2 days to catch up to Moises Gomez, who's got 38. But Matt Mervis leads he's second in home runs. He leads the minors in RBI. He leads the minors in extra base hits. He leads the minors in total bases. And pretty good story, because he began the year. He turned 24 in April, but he began the year in high A. Like he was interesting. He was a two-way player at Duke. We had the 5-round pandemic draft in 2020, so he didn't get picked. He would have been a 6th to 10th round guy. And he was a priority non-drafted free agent for a lot of clubs. And the Cubs moved very quickly and aggressively to sign him as soon as you were allowed to sign non-drafted free agents, and landed him. And he came out last year, and he really didn't have a very good year. He hit 208, 9 homers in 72 games. Mostly in low A as a 23-year-old. You know, he was old for the level, didn't perform. So you could have argued, I think, coming into the year that maybe his career wasn't, like, if he didn't perform this year, you know, especially with the roster limits in the minor leagues, his career might have been in trouble. And instead, you know, I think the biggest differences for him this year is that he's making better swing decisions. He's kind of tightened up his left-handed swing. It's not as long. It's more direct. He's always had bat speed and strength. And I think more than any Cubs prospect this year, he probably has the best combination of exit velocity and making contact. Now he's first base only guy, but the power's real. He's been on fire. I think I know he homered yesterday. I think he's hit like about 11 homers in the last month. And as I said, although I shouldn't probably have said this, because we're probably going to do our total bases draft for the fall league again, but I do like Matt Mervis to win the AFL home run title. I mean, he's had a lot of success in AAA. So he's already faced, consistently better pitching than he will in the fall league, which is kind of double A level, but in 55 triple A games, he's hit 15 home runs. He has not slowed down at all at that level.
Wow. Jim, giving up some intel there, giving up
shocking
total base AFL fantasy.
I think Matt Mervis is going to do terribly in the AFL. I would not draft him if anybody was doing it.
Oh, wait, he's changed his mind.
That was like,
I thought about it.
Was that like a Jedi mind trick you just tried to pull there? What was that?
Now nobody's going to want Mervis.
This is not the slugger you want.
You were right, by the way, Jim. Last year's Arizona Fall League home run champion was, in fact, organization mate Nelson Velasquez. Hit 9 dingers. You know the last time we had double-digit home runs in the Arizona Fall League?
Brandon Wood.
I can only think of Brandon Wood with 14.
Brandon Wood is, yeah, the all-time home run champ in 2005, but we have had some double-digit home run hitters in the Fall League since then.
What year was it?
2011.
So before I went for MLB.com.
Also a former Cub, but was not with the Cubs.
Josh Donaldson?
When he was in the Fall League. No.
I refuse to randomly guess.
But that does kind of fit in. Was with the Rangers at the time.
Chris McGinnis?
Michael.
I don't know if he was with the Cubs, but.
Olt hit 13.
Oh, Michael Olt.
Oh, Michael.
Wow.
Yeah. Hit 13 in 2011. Had a very, very good Arizona Fall League. All right. Where are we? Peoria. Let's hit the Javelinas. And Jonathan, wow us with your pick.
I'm going to woo you with my pick. That was too easy, but thank you for that. I'm going to take Brian Wu of the Mariners. It's one of those interesting guys who I wasn't on the top 30 to start the year and added him. And the Mariners, you know, Jim, you've been doing this long enough. Sometimes the player development folks, like, they have a hard time containing their excitement about a guy who's a little bit under the radar still. And that was the case with Brian Wu. They took him in the 6th round of last year's draft out of Cal Poly. But the reason why he's so under the radar is he got hurt in the spring and needed Tommy John surgery. But showed off enough arm strength that took him in the 6th round. Not only did he get back on the mound, but he actually threw 57 innings last year and made it to high A. The overall numbers are just okay. He especially once he got up to high A, he did get knocked around a little bit, but he missed a ton of bats. I mean, he struck out over 13 per 9, threw a good amount of strikes. It's a really interesting arm who, and this was just this half of a year, of pitching post rehabbing Tommy John surgery. So who knows exactly what. Yeah, but in shorter stints, it's upper 90s with the fastball. Sometimes it can be a little straight. That can lead to him being a little hittable, but his hard slider is really good. That could end up being an above average or plus pitch later on. He's got a pretty good changeup with good run on it. And he does have a curveball. He shelved it, but he had it in college. He's going to start folding that back in. So we're talking maybe 4 pitches, 3 at least average. And all he needs is more mound time, and he's going to start getting it with Peoria.
All right, Jim, hit us with a Javelina.
Yeah, I'm going to go with Alec Jacob of the Padres. And he, we're going to talk about best 2022 pro debuts by 2022 draftees a little bit later in the podcast. And Alec Jacob made our 2021 list for best debuts. He was a 16th round pick out of Gonzaga, West Coast Conference Pitcher of the Year. In his draft year, but the reason he lasted 16 rounds is he throws, generally throws around 87, 89 miles an hour with fastball with some sink, but he's a side armor. Guys don't hit the fastball very much because of the difficult angle, especially righties. He's got a low 70s changeup that fades arm side for him. And then he's got a sweeping low 70s slider that breaks in the exact opposite direction. And he not only had a great debut last year when he didn't give up a earned run in 19 and two-thirds innings, he kept that momentum this year. He got to AAA in his first full pro season, struck out 77 guys in 57 innings, throws a ton of strikes. I think this is a high floor, lower ceiling guy, but I would not be surprised if we see him in San Diego at some point next year. It looks like a outstanding 16th round pick for the Padres.
And the Javelinas comprised of Guardians, not Indians, Mets, Padres, Mariners, and Nats. Salt River Rafters. This is a squad made up of D-backs, Rockies, Tigers, Cardinals, and Blue Jays. Jonathan?
So this is the one guy who I didn't sort of stick to our outside of a team top 10. And part of it is because I don't think people know about him, and part of it is because his name is Warming Bernabeu, and it's one of the best names in the minor leagues, and I needed to give him some love. He's currently the Rockies' number 8 prospect, signed back at the start of the international signing period in 2018, so July 2018. He's pretty much hit wherever he's gone. You know, his pro debut was okay. Last year, he, you know, just absolutely tore up the Arizona Complex League and made it to full season ball. This year, he hit across two levels of A ball and hit both of them, finished with a 313 average and 869 OPS. Power started to show up, hit 14 homers, makes a ton of contact, just doesn't strike out, learning to be a little more selective. And sometimes these guys have such innate bat-to-ball skills, they get themselves out because they can make contact with everything. And I think he's learning to be able to drive the ball and find his pitch and things like that. But for a guy who hasn't played above A-ball, he's moved over to third. I think he should be pretty good at third when all is said and done. And I think the bat should profile pretty well there. And this could be a good coming out party for him and a guy who will use this as a springboard to the upper levels next year.
All right. Jim, you've got a Tiger for us?
I do. I went with Parker Meadows of the Tigers. He's Austin's little brother. Second round pick in 2018. And really didn't do much in his first two full pro seasons in 2019 and then 2021 after the pandemic. Got off to a slow start this year, but really, you know, made some adjustments and took off in the second half of the season. He's 6'5", 205. It's plus speed. It's plus raw power. You know, he's had a reputation for having hitch in his swing that was kind of preventing him from producing at the plate on a consistent basis. But, you know, starting in June, last 4 months of the season, he was, you know, finished very well, hit 8 homers in August, hit 355 in September. You know, if that surge is real, if he could keep that going, then, you know, there's legitimate tools here. He can play center. He's got a solid arm, so he could really play anywhere in the outfield. You know, we could see him, you know, in the big leagues, you know, next year. He spent this year in Double A, you know, has, you know, he's going to try to build on that momentum. And, you know, could be a guy who begins next year in Triple A. You know, obviously Detroit's going through some rebuilding and regime change and all that, but he's a guy who I think we could see in the big leagues next year as well.
All right. Scottsdale Scorpions, Braves, Orioles, Red Sox, Angels, and Giants. Jonathan.
Yeah, you know, so the Angels have had a, you know, a history of drafting over the last several years, especially a few years back, you know, high upside, up the middle, high school guys, you know, good athletes. You know, a little bit of a risk reward. And this year they're sending Kyren Paris to the Fall League. And I think he is a good candidate to kind of have a little bit of a breakout. And even though he's coming off a bad year, dropped down to number 20 on their top 30 overall. And the overall numbers don't look great, except if you look at what he did when he got bumped up to Double A for the last 2 weeks of the season, where he had an OPS of 1151. He in our last version of our hottest hitting prospect for each team feature, he was the Angels pick, you know, because he hit 354 and slugged 77 over that last month with 6 homers and 7 steals. So I'm thinking maybe he's starting to figure some things out. It's a good power combination. Probably see him at play short and second base in the Fall League. And it'd be interesting to see if maybe a light has started to go off in terms of him tapping into what are some pretty impressive raw tools that he brought with him, you know, ever since the Angels took him in the second round of the 2019 draft.
Jim, you've got a guy who did put up good numbers this year, but in sort of limited time, and we haven't seen a lot of them over the past few years.
Yeah, that would be Thad Ward, a right-hander in the Red Sox organization. He was a reliever at Central Florida in college, and they converted him to pro starter, and he's had pretty much consistent success, except he had a detour with the pandemic and Tommy John surgery. He was their minor league pitcher of the year, Boston's minor league pitcher of the year in 2019, missed 2020 with the pandemic, made two starts last year before he had Tommy John surgery, came back this year and pitched really well, 66 strikeouts, 51 in third innings, 2.28 ERA at four different levels, most of that time in Double A, where he had a 2.43 ERA in seven starts. You know, his best pitch is a slider. He's got one of the better sliders in the Red Sox system. It could get into the mid-80s with late action. He can throw for strikes. He can use his chase pitch. 92, 96 mile an hour sinker that gets a lot of ground balls. He's got a changeup that's in progress, throws a reasonable amount of strikes. There is a big league future for him. I think they're going to try to develop him as a starter. He could always fall back and be a two pitch reliever if need be. So this is just helping him make up for some innings he lost. He only pitched, like I said, 51 and third this year after eight last year. And your fun Thad Ward trivia fact is that when he was growing up in Fort Myers, Florida, which is the spring training home of the Red Sox, he served as a Red Sox bat boy during spring training.
Wow. Nice one. All right, you are listening to the MLB Pipeline Podcast. We're identifying sleeper prospects for the Arizona Fall League. One team to go. Surprise. It's a surprise.
I'm not surprised by that.
Not surprised at all. The surprise, Saguaros, Astros, Royals, Phillies, Pirates, and Rangers. Jonathan.
Well, so I have a little trivia tidbit for my pick. Blake Sable, the Pirates, is, I'm doing it like a Jeopardy, is related to which NFL Hall of Famer?
Ooh. Who is Troy Polamalu?
You can't ring in until the end of the question. Have you never watched Jeopardy?
Sorry.
But you were very excited about that.
I was very excited. You know I'm a Steelers fan.
I do. Did you know that one, Jason?
I did, yes.
Did you know that Blake Sable was promoted from the taxi squad to full-time roster status today?
I also knew that. Two for two.
I did know that. In fact, I might have picked Matt Gorski, who had a very good year, has very good tools, but got dinged up the end of the year. I think that's probably why they removed him. But Blake Sable is kind of an interesting guy because he really looked more like an organizational guy. The Pirates took him in the seventh round in 2019 out of Southern Cal. Had been a pretty good high school prospect, but wanted to go to USC. Very modest numbers in college. Started to show off last year that he hit. But it was an A ball and he was 23. He's now 24. So he's a little bit older, but the power started to show up in Altoona. He got bumped up to AAA Indianapolis. He continued to hit really well there. An OPS over 1,000 in AAA as they're finishing up there. And also, I think the player development staff really appreciated the fact that this is a guy who had caught back in college, had been moved to the outfield and only really played the outfield. And then last year said, hey, I'll go back behind the plate because they needed catching. Now, I don't know whether or not he can catch. Maybe he's a guy who's a third catcher and plays the outfield. He plays a pretty decent outfield, and it's starting to show a kind of profile that might look good in an outfield corner. Being that he's in AAA, there is some outfield depth in the Pirates organization, but his ability to maybe toggle back and forth when there is not catching that's ready for the big leagues yet could put him in Pittsburgh, as early as opening day next year, or at least earn him, a spot on the 40-man roster and see what happens from there.
All right. Last Arizona Fall League sleeper prospect, Jim.
I'm going to go with Aaron Savala. And he's
good pick.
He probably stretches the definition of sleeper a little bit. He's number 11 on our Rangers list, but I do feel like the Rangers top 10 might be as deep as anybody's top 10. But second round pick last year. I think both Jonathan and I thought he was one of the best college hitters in last year's draft, Pac-12 Conference Player of the Year. And, listeners may not remember this, but there was like some drama on signing deadline day because second round pick, no reason to think there was anything going on. And there was a medical anomaly that was revealed during his post-draft physical that, it's since more has been reported on it. It was a growth on his, at the top of his cervical spine. And they weren't sure exactly what to make of this. They knew it wasn't cancerous at first, but they weren't really sure. They found this out late in the process. Like, what does this mean going forward? Is he going to be able to play? There was a lot of uncertainty going on. So he didn't sign, and he signed for well below slot on draft day, which the Rangers then used the savings to sign some other guys. But the good news is after about 2 weeks after he signed, and they got some more opinions from neurologists and orthopedists, that it was determined they need to monitor the growth, but it doesn't need any further attention at that, you know, unless it gets bigger, which it hasn't, and that he's not any risk by playing. And so, you know, given the go-ahead to go ahead and play, you know, he's not surprisingly hit very well in pro ball. He's hit .280 in two pro seasons. He's got 17 homers and 23 steals in 133 pro games. He made it to Double A this year. He's hit for more power each level as he's gone up. And this guy's just he's a super advanced hitter. I think he's going to be more hit over power. I think he's got a chance to be a plus hitter. It might be more average power. One of those guys who's going to draw a ton of walks, being on base guy. I could see this guy batting in the first or second slot for the Rangers in a year or two. He could just really, really hit. So I'm looking forward to seeing him perform in the fall league, and happy for him that after some initial, you know, scares to what exactly was he dealing with, is he going to be able to play pro ball, that it appears that everything looks good.
An on base machine.
Indeed.
89 walks in 111 games this year. All right, that is a look at some sleeper prospects in the Arizona Fall League. Be sure to stay tuned to MLB.com/pipeline. Follow us on Twitter. We'll be covering the Fall League in depth on a daily basis. And also MLB.com/AFL to get to complete Fall League coverage. That begins again on October 3rd. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we will preview some of our year-end awards. That's coming up next on the MLB Pipeline Podcast. Welcome back to the MLB Pipeline Podcast. Jason Ratliff here with Jim Callis and Jonathan Mayo. We talked AFL sleeper prospects, and now we are going to look ahead to some of our year-end awards. We have the Prospect Team of the Year, where we will name a first and second team player per position. And then we'll also have the hitting and pitching prospects of the year for each organization, as well as the overall hitting and pitching prospects of the year for 2022. Those are all coming your way within the next couple of weeks. And we'll whet the appetite a little bit here by previewing the Prospect Team of the Year, where we're considering everyone at each position, but then whittling it down to the top contenders. Let's start behind the plate and look at some of the top contenders there. Andy Rodriguez, Logan Ohapi, Edward Cuero, of course, MLB's number one overall prospect, Francisco Alvarez.
The three first baseman finalists in no particular order are Matt Mervis of the Cubs, who talked about earlier in the pod, Kyle Manzardo of the Rays, and Nico Cavadas. Is that right, Jim, as our Red Sox guy?
Yes, you pronounced that very well.
Okay, thank you very much.
You should have done that in a Greek
five
accent.
Years of Greek.
Yes, that's it's all Greek to me. The Red Sox, those are the three first basemen.
And now I'll give you the three second base finalists. We have Michael Busch of the Dodgers. I will use my high school French here. Edouard Julien of the Twins, who was also discussed earlier during the sleeper portion. And Emmanuel Valdez, who began the season with the Astros and got traded to the Red Sox.
And next up, third base, got some big names here. Highest ranked prospect headed out to the Arizona Fall League, Jordan Walker, one of them, along with Brett Beatty, Miguel Vargas, who ended up in the big leagues, as did Beatty this year, and then Christian Encarnacion Strand, who split the season between Cincinnati and Minnesota organizations.
This is going to come as a shock, the shortstop finalists. Ellie De La Cruz is being considered. I'm not sure why, but obviously the Reds infielder, who is now officially a friend of the pod, on the list, Gunnar Henderson of the Orioles and Vaughn Grissom of the Braves. Of course, Henderson and Grissom also making their stamp at the big league level as well.
Now I'll rattle off now nine outfield finalists. We've got Vaughn Brown of the Giants, Kerry Carpenter of the Tigers, Corbin Carroll of the Diamondbacks, Jackson Churio who I've already anointed breakout prospect of the year of the Brewers. That's four. We've got James Outman of the Dodgers, Esturio Ruiz, who went from the Padres to the Brewers in the Hader trade. We have Matt Waldner of the Twins, Moises Gomez of the Cardinals, who's our current minor league home run leader, and Justin Durden of the Astros are our nine outfield finalists.
All right, to the mound. Start on the left side. Some nice names here. Ricky Tiedemann of the Blue Jays, Kyle Harrison of the Giants, Mason Montgomery of the Rays.
Some good names among right-handed starters as well. Andrew Painter of the Phillies, Gavin Williams of the Guardians, Gavin Stone of the Padres, and Brandon Pfaadt of the Diamondbacks. He of the 200 plus strikeouts. So some good names to consider there.
Did you just give the Padres Gavin Stone?
Oh, did he? Is there a trade?
I think
Jonathan announced a trade.
Did I say
breaking
the Padres?
I don't know. I thought.
I think I was so intent on making sure I said Guardians for Gavin Williams that I may have just made a mistake. Gavin Stone of the Dodgers. My apologies.
I may have just made that up.
If I got that wrong. Yeah, it's all good. Better to be safe.
I was in my head practicing the pronunciation for one of the reliever finalists, and so I missed that. But our three reliever finalists to wrap up our list of candidates for the prospect team of the year, we have Edgar Barclay of the Yankees.
That's not Brixey. That tough to say, Jim.
No, I know. Zach Brixey. You're up to me in the middle of Brixey, but Zach Brixey, which is BRZYKCY of the Nationals, and Eric Torres of the Angels are your three reliever finalists.
All right. So in looking at all of these different positions, what are some that stood out to you guys as being difficult decisions?
I thought, Jonathan, at least for me, the second base was maybe the toughest decision. I felt like, you know, the players were similar age, similar levels, similar stats. None of them is a particularly fluid defensive second baseman. That's Michael Busch. I just wanted to say Edouard Julien again. And Emmanuel Valdez. They're very similar players. And so I thought you were really splitting hairs. That one was pretty tough.
I think I agree. And sometimes I think the thinking would be, oh, the tough decision is going to be where there's really, really good players. I think the same token, first base was challenging just in that, you know, because, you know, when you look at Matt Mervis and what he did home run wise, and you're trying to compare that to a guy like Kyle Manzardo, who didn't hit for as much power, you know, always was a hit over power guy in college. So that one was interesting. And I felt like some of the outfield choices, so there were so many outfielders who had really good years, and trying to weigh, you know, putting together a really good year with prospect-y goodness, to coin your phrase, Jim, was a little challenging with the group of outfielders.
Yeah, and I'd say the one other position I'd throw in there was just third base, where you had three outstanding prospects in Brett Beatty and Miguel Vargas and Jordan Walker. And then you had Christian Encarnacion Strand, who had 32 homers and 114 RBIs and had better pure numbers than all of them. So I thought that was kind of a tough position as well. Like I could easily pick four third basemen, and maybe we'll throw some of those guys into a DH spot or something. But I thought that one was a pretty tough one too. The pitchers felt pretty easy to me.
Speaking of prospecty goodness, I wanted you guys to kind of break down how this works, what you're looking at, what factors in the most. Obviously, you're obviously looking at the statistics, but also age, level, and also explain who's eligible for this, because a guy like Julio Rodriguez, who was a prospect at the beginning of the season, would not be eligible for these awards, right?
Well, he did not play at all in the minors. So, yeah, I mean, we're celebrating minor leaguers here. It's based on minor league performance. So I don't think we have a minimum, but if you don't play a lot in the minors, you're not going to put up enough numbers to make the list. But essentially, I think any minor leaguer who is on a top 30 prospect list at some point this season. And I know for me personally, I mean, I do factor prospecting goodness into it. I mean, and you have to look at age and level, like you said, Jason. I'd say for me, it's maybe 60-65% performance and, you know, 35-40% prospecting goodness. Like, that is going to, you know, sway it for me in the end, you know, if two guys are close.
I think, yeah, I mean, I think that's about right. And sometimes it's more feel than, but that ratio sounds about right. Maybe I'd go 70-30. You know, this team tends to be, you know, on a week-to-week basis, it's performance-based. So it's maybe a little bit more performance-based than just picking a all-prospects team, you know, in terms of figuring out that the sort of the prospect part of it. So, yeah, maybe I skew a little bit more toward performance, but it's in the same ballpark.
Isn't the eligibility rule that these guys have to have spent at least half the season in the minors?
I mean, I don't...
You think that's like more of a guideline than a...
I mean, you aren't going to make the team if you played 45 games in the minors. So maybe it is. I don't know. I don't think I would ever pick anybody who only played like 65 games in the minors. So, and I don't think any of our candidates do. So I don't know. I do not know the answer to that question.
All right. So prospect team of the year, the organizational hitting and pitching prospects of the year, and the overall hitting and pitching prospects of the year coming your way soon on MLB Pipeline. We are going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to look at some of the best pro debuts by 2022 draftees. That's coming up next on the MLB Pipeline podcast. Welcome back to the MLB Pipeline podcast. Jim Callis, Jonathan Mayo, I'm Jason Ratliff, and we are going to talk about some 2022 draftees who got drafted in July, made their pro debuts this summer, and impressed. There's a story up on MLB Pipeline now by Jim, where he identified. How many players did you end up identifying, Jim? Because I know you...
Well, you know, when I looked at last year's story, I was like, geez, I did 15 guys last year. That's a lot. So I tried to cut it to 12, and then I kept discovering more guys. So I wound up going 16 deep.
Are you going to add one each year?
I'm going to set a calendar reminder. This is a very Jason Ratliff thing to do for next year, to see, make sure Jim complains about how he did X amount of players in this story. Time.
Well, see, the thing was, I felt like I had to be fair, because like one of the guys I cited, Mason Barnett, had 8 scoreless innings. I was like, oh, John Michael Bertrand had 8 scoreless innings. I got to add him. And then I realized, oh, I only have one high school guy in this list. So I was like, oh, I'll get Cole Young on there. And it just kept growing. So, yeah, it's like, it's a good thing I cut myself off. If, you know, it might be up to 20 by now if the deadline had been today or something.
All right. So we're going to talk about the highest drafted player on the list and the lowest drafted player on the list, but somebody else you wanted to talk about here, Jim.
Yeah, I was going to give, maybe most impressive debuts. If I had to pick the two most impressive debuts, the Angels sent at least 3 of their players out of the draft to Double A. Ben Joyce went there directly, third rounder. Zach Neto, their first rounder, went there after some time in High A. And they both thrived. I mean, Joyce, who we've talked about numerous times on this podcast because he hit 105 mile an hour with his fastball at Tennessee this spring, and he averaged 101. He went to Double A, only pitched, you know, one inning at a time. You know, kind of kept him, you know, handled him carefully like Tennessee did. But 2.08 ERA in Double A, 20 strikeouts in 13 innings. Last two appearances, he struck out the side in both. So that was impressive. And then, you know, Neto, who... you know, highest ever pick from Campbell, 13th overall, back-to-back Big South Conference Player of the Year, career 403 hitter in college. Well, he kept hitting, even though he played in High A and Double A. He had a combined 299, 377, 476, 15 extra base hits, and led all draftees with 44 hits in 37 games. So I thought it was very impressive that those guys not only survived going to Double A, that both Ben Joyce and Zach Neto thrived in Double A. Not even trying to rhyme, but I thought those were the two most impressive debuts for me.
Either of you get any reports, or have you heard anything about Joyce's velocity at AA?
I have not, but I can do that and report back next week.
There we go.
Jonathan is Mr. Angel, as he's known in the pipeline.
That's true.
Pipeline environs.
He is angelic.
Very kind of you.
Jonathan, hit us with you're gonna give us the highest.
Yeah, I'm gonna cherry pick right off the top. And Jackson Holliday, and he didn't play a ton, right? It was 20 games total when all was said and done. 64 at bats. But it is always nice when, especially if you take a high school guy, number one overall, and he goes out and hits right away. And he did. He made quick work in his time in the complex league. Hit over 400 over eight games. Got moved up to finish out the summer in low A. The numbers obviously weren't as good there, but overall with a 9.11 OPS, you know, in those 20 games, and hits the ground running to hit full season ball full time next year. I don't think it would shock anybody. The son of former All-Star Matt Holliday, if he was the kind of high schooler that moves a little bit more quickly, ridiculous tools, the ability to stay at the premium position at shortstop for a long time, got better as the spring went on. That's how he ended up number one overall. So very promising start, and another elite level prospect that the Orioles were able to add to their already deep farm system.
And I'm going to go with the other end of the spectrum, the lowest pick who made my top 322 pro debuts of the summer, top 16, was Cameron Wagner, the Brewers, who is an 11th rounder out of Eastern Michigan. And he wound up, he led all draftees with 3 wins, 19 and two thirds innings. Most pitchers did not pitch much this summer, and a 24-2 strikeout to walk ratio while putting up a 1.83 ERA between rookie ball and single A. And he's an 11th rounder out of Eastern Michigan. And I was thinking, that's kind of odd. The way we split up the draft, Michigan's one of my states. And I was like, I don't remember anybody talking about Cameron Wagner. 11th round pick isn't that low. It's usually you target a guy you want to come out. That's first round on the third day of the draft, a guy you want. And so I looked him up, and he hadn't pitched this spring. And I was like, what's going on? And then I did a little bit more digging, texted Brewer scouting director Todd Johnson, who's always great about getting back to us quickly. And I said, hey, what was the story with Cameron Wagner? Like, why didn't he pitch this spring? I assumed maybe he'd been hurt or something. And he was academically ineligible is what was going on. He got to pitch a little bit in the Cape Cod League before the draft to show what he can do. And he ran his fastball up to 97 miles an hour and his slider up to 87. And that's why the Brewers pounced on him in the 11th round. And so far, so good. Very, very strong debut for Cameron Wagner.
All right. Again, that story on best debuts by 2022 draft picks is on MLB.com/pipeline. Now check it out there. Let's wrap this thing up with a question from the mailbag. We built so much intrigue at the beginning of the show.
So much
about where this question came from. Ladies and gentlemen, it came from not Twitter, but Instagram. Can you believe it?
Oh my God.
Thanks to Kelsey Hennigan, who put my plea for questions on Instagram and actually forwarded, I think she forwarded them to all of us, but must have been like 20 questions. She did this a couple weeks ago for
Pipeline
Inbox.
Yielded a nice little bounty.
Yeah, she did it for Pipeline Inbox a couple weeks ago. And I think, I don't remember if we used a question that week. Maybe not, because you were so excited this week, Jason. I guess we didn't use it on the podcast, but I know on Pipeline Inbox that week, two of my four questions were Instagram related. So thank you to all the Instagram users who responded to our ask for questions.
And the one that was chosen came from Instagram handle KCAYDE, who asks, for the draft, would you rather have the number one overall pick or the highest bonus pool?
And since I just dominated the draft debut section, since it was my story.
Jim, you need to answer this question in a series of photos.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, that'll be very good on the podcast. I was going to defer to Jonathan and let Jonathan have first crack at this question if he wished.
What year is it?
Well, obviously, the thing that's tough, well, not tough, but like how close are the bonus pools? Like I guess I looked at it like they're reasonably close. It's not like $4 million more or something.
I guess if we're going to look in a general sense without, really knowing about any of those variables. I think I would take the highest bonus pool. You know, it is tough because sometimes there's a number one pick that you want that player. But I think given what things have looked like over the last 2 years, I think I would rather have more money to work with. Not that you necessarily get cute with it, but you could still pick the best player. If you have the highest bonus pool, you're picking in the top five in all likelihood, and then you also have some extra picks. So you could still take the best player and have the money to be aggressive later on in the draft. So I think having the highest bonus pool gives you the best chance at impacting your farm system and your organization the most in a given draft.
And it's interesting because I would lean the other way. Now, obviously, you know, like I said, obviously it would depend. If we're talking like $5 million difference, I'd rather have the highest bonus pool. If we're talking about I have the first pick and maybe some other team has the third pick and they have a competitive balance pick and that puts them ahead of me, I'd rather have my crack at taking the guy who I thought was the best player in the draft from the standpoint of you can't always guarantee that guys you're going to want later are going to get there, that you can always push them there. But it's interesting. I mean, I guess if neither of us have done the research, we could do an hour-long podcast, Jonathan, where we delve into what bonus pool difference, you know, would we you know, change our decision. But I would lean.
That's next week.
Yeah, exactly. A full hour.
That and an update on Ben Joyce's velocity.
And we'll do come up with some more French names to pronounce as well. But yeah, I think I would rather be able to get any player who I wanted in the draft. You know, like, you know, there's obviously some years where you have an Adelaide Rutschman and a Bobby Witt, and you know, and it's a deep draft. And there's other years where there's a clear number one. I would rather have the comfort of knowing I can have any player I want. And also, the flip side is if I have the number one overall pick, I also know I'm going to have a high bonus pool as well. Even if it's not number one, I'm going to have a really good bonus pool. So I would lean that. But it's an interesting question, which is why we picked it.
All right. Thanks very much to Instagram handle KCAYDE for that question. And thanks to everyone for listening. Jonathan, you want to sneak something in here real quick?
Well, we were speaking French. I want to throw in a little Hebrew. A little Shana Tova, Happy New Year to those who celebrate 5783, in case you're keeping track on the Hebrew calendar.
And that is a wrap for this week's MLB Pipeline podcast. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss an episode. If you're enjoying the show or have any suggestions, leave us a rating and a review. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you next week.